The scripture reading today will come from the book Matthew chapter 25, verses 1 through 4. Chapter 25, 1 through 4. And at the time, the kingdom of heaven will be like 10 virgins who took their lamps and went out to meet the bridegroom. 5 of them were foolish and 5 were wise. The foolish ones took their lamps, but did not take any oil with them. The wise ones, however, took oil in jars along with their lamps.
Good morning. Tucker and I have slightly different microphone heights to work with. I wasn't making fun of you. I'm just a giant. We're continuing our series on the crimes of Jesus of Nazareth, where we've been looking at the last half of the book of Matthew. And the question we've been trying to track along as we've considered it is, what is it that Jesus did that got him killed? At the beginning of the week, you have a group of people saying, Hosanna to the Son of David, throwing down their coats in front of him and the palm branches and so forth, and blessed is he that comes in the name of the Lord. All these wonderful things they say to him and about him. And then by the end of the week, maybe a different group of people, but a similar group of people are chanting, crucify him, give us Barabbas, and willing participants in the death of Jesus Christ, saying, going so far as to say, his blood being upon us and our children forever. So what happens to the likable country preacher, the man heralded as the hope of Israel, Messiah, and would-be king on Sunday morning, who is crucified on a Friday? What happens in that week? And as I've commented, I think our failure quite often is to appreciate what takes place there, that something does happen, that Jesus is of such a nature and quality, and his teachings of such a nature and quality, that he could make people angry enough to want to kill him. That's not a point to be overlooked. If the teachings of Jesus never make us angry, I hope that don't keep you angry, don't get me wrong, but if at some point in your life you don't hear something Jesus says and say, well, I just don't like that, then we weren't listening. Because this is a man that people killed, ordinary people, religious people, like us, lynched this man because of the things that he did and taught. So this series of lessons has been trying to understand what it is that Jesus did as portrayed in the book of Matthew. Last week, we got to the heart of it. We were in Matthew 23, and if there was any question, it's gone now. Matthew 23 is just this brutal rant against the religious practices of his day and how they had undermined, subverted, and in many cases reversed the will of God for his people. And it's an excoriating sermon delivered against them. Today we're going to skip a bit in Matthew. We're going to skip Matthew 24, though I reserve the right to refer to it often. Matthew 24 comes on the heels of that. So Matthew 23 is the rebuke. These are the sins that you're guilty of. But sin leads to judgment. And so Matthew 24 is a picture of judgment of various kinds. There's at least, in my understanding of Matthew 24, at least two kinds of judgment in that passage. One, a near and local one. This religious institution you fought so hard to protect is going to be taken from you. But more than that, the passage ends by pointing out that God's judgment is ultimate, that God's judgment is certain, and that there will come a day, whether you get past this moment in history or not, there will come a time when all people ultimately have to answer to the moral judgment of their God. And so Matthew 23 is the rebuke, sin leads to judgment, and now we have this prediction of dire warning and doom. Judgment leads to warning. So Matthew 25, follow the flow of thought, here's what you've done wrong, here's what it's going to cost you, here's what you need to do about it. Matthew 25 is a slightly less brutal correction now. In fact, we could say after Matthew 23, everything is less severe. After Matthew 23, everything seems softer. But this eases up just a little bit, taps the brakes just a little bit, and says this is what needs to happen next. But even here, we're going to find a teaching so difficult to hear that I think it continues to provoke those who would ultimately kill him. In Matthew 25, we have what is for many of you the familiar passage, a familiar parable of the wise and foolish virgins, or the ten virgins. And what I think he does by setting up these two groups is to show us there are two responses to what Jesus has said. Do you know that warnings are great and all, but you have to do something about a warning? We see natural disasters on the news. In our age of television, you can see, you know, the natural disaster and the police and the National Guard go out and there's a forest fire raging, approaching a neighborhood, or there's a flood coming up the Mississippi, and the people go to the house and they say, hey, you got to get out of here. Flood, fire, mudslide, earthquake, I don't know, something. Bad things happen, maybe not an earthquake. I don't know how you'd really warn people about that one. Never mind, don't listen to the preacher. Bad things happening, warning is coming, you've got to do something about it. And invariably, 12 hours later, there's going to be some guy getting rescued by a helicopter off of his rooftop because he stayed where he wasn't supposed to be. He probably looked like me because he was stubborn, right? That stubbornness in us, that we don't always respond to warnings. And so that's why Jesus goes through the painstaking process in Matthew 25 a couple of times. Next week as well, Lord willing, to remind us that it's important not just to hear the warning, not just to believe the warning, but to do something about it. In verses 1 and 2, he says, then the kingdom of heaven will be like 10 virgins who took their lamps and went to meet the bridegroom. 5 of them were foolish, 5 of them were wise. Now, this is a little difficult for us to understand because, like so many things in the teachings of Jesus, it's rooted in the practice and culture of its time. Modern wedding ceremony is going to be somewhat different than an ancient ceremony. For one thing, they're shorter. When I do weddings now, the most common thing I hear, now this is after mom and dad have left and the bride and groom are in the room with me, they say, keep it really short. Most common thing I hear, I always ask, is there a favorite passage you'd like for me to include? Do you have a nice poem that you'd like? Some beautiful magisterial talk about love and godliness? Could you do it in like 15 minutes? Which is funny to me because I know how much she spent on that dress. And I think, don't you just want to wear it a little while? But and in any event, that's the thing. So in the ancient world, the wedding ceremony, I don't know what kind of ceremony they had, but it was accompanied by a feast. And this may go on for days. I mean, this is a big deal. It was an enormous community-wide celebration. Towns were smaller, just to be blunt with you. Towns were smaller. Somebody got married. It was a big deal. The whole town came out. Somebody throws a feast, and everyone has a good time. And so it goes late into the night, and it carries over. And that seems to be what's going on here. Something akin to that is that we have some kind of wedding ceremony, some festive occasion, and the wedding party is waiting for their turn. So all ceremonies have a little bit of the ceremonial in them, okay? So we got a group of people, and they got one job, and that is when the bridegroom and the wedding party comes out of the house, you go with them to the feast where everyone's waiting because we like little pageantry, right? That's your job. Now, they know that these kinds of things tend to go on a bit, and so they bring their lamps. There's two groups. And it's interesting that in this, to soften it just a little bit, he doesn't even say there were the good ones and the evil wedding attendants, right? That's not what he says. It's not good and evil. That's not the point he makes. If he softens it just a little bit, he says there's wise and there's foolish. He's already done the good and evil bit. You read Matthew 23, he's had his say about good and evil. He's now saying how you respond to that moves past good and evil and just has to do with wise and foolish. What are you going to do with what you have heard? Will you act foolishly or wisely? And what will that look like? In verse 3 and following, the parable continues, and we see the problem has to do with these lamps that don't have oil. Matthew 25, 3 and 4. For when the foolish took their lamps, they took no oil with them. But the wise took flasks of oil with their lamps. If you get at the good commentaries, they get really particular about trying to figure out exactly what kind of light source this, what kind of lamp this is, and what kind of flask, and what kind. I've seen pictures of what I think it might be, but the point is actually you don't have to know that. You don't need to know what kind of wattage the bulb was to get the idea it wasn't a bulb. But the point is it was a lamp, and it requires fuel. You have to have oil, right? And you have to make it work. And fuel burns until it's gone. So again, for maybe the younger folks in our audience, put yourself back a ways where there isn't just an unlimited supply of energy to power your device as long as you might like. First world problems. I was visiting with good Mr. Caldwell Friday night at the football game at Beggs, and at halftime, the band didn't perform, so the band kids are kind of walking around, and one comes up to Mr. Caldwell and says, hey, where can I plug in my phone? And this is, I mean, if I hadn't heard those words, I might have thought someone was dying. I mean, the distress in his voice, my phone's, where can I plug it in? And Matt says, yeah, sorry about you. You know, I mean, they're just, we're in a stadium. They don't have plug-ins on every seat. You know, right? That's not the way it works. And he's, oh, okay. So here's a person who was unprepared for what he wanted to do. But the point is that there's a little difference between the modern and ancient world, and sometimes we remember that, that you have this lamp, and that's great and all, but you've got to have fuel for it, or eventually it's going to go out. And how much fuel you have kind of depends on how long you think it's going to go. Okay, so some of them bring fuel, some of them bring extra. Now, when it says they took no oil with them, let me just clarify. I don't think it means they literally had a lamp and zero oil. I think what it means is they had oil in their lamp, they didn't bring extra oil. But they anticipated, oh, this will be good enough. Walking out the door in a hurry, this ought to be fine. There's some in there, isn't there? Like when you go on a long trip and you say, oh, well, you can get 20 miles in an empty tank. We ought to be off, okay? And you kind of guesstimate how much you need, and you're wrong. So the difference here is a very simple difference. It's not complex. See how much softer this is compared to last week's sermon? It's a very simple distinction, he says. Some people walked out the door prepared that night, and some did not. And because of that, some were wise, and some were foolish. What did the fools do wrong? They were unprepared. What did the wise do right? They were prepared. And that's the only distinction. And I want to emphasize that because the next verse, it gets read wrong quite a lot. There's a detail in this parable that always gets overlooked. Look in verse 5. As the bridegroom was delayed, they all became drowsy and slept. I've heard this sermon preached so many times where we're critical. Those foolish virgins who fell asleep and weren't prepared and weren't ready and weren't awake, that's not what the parable is about. All 10 virgins fall asleep in verse 5. None of them correctly guessed how long it was going to take. All of them were surprised by how long this next part of the ceremony took to get started. All of them. All of them fell asleep. And that's maybe a surprise to us, because elsewhere in the Bible, sleep is kind of a bad thing, right? In fact, in this book, in Matthew, a little later, Jesus goes to the Garden of Gethsemane and his disciples fall asleep while he's praying. Jesus is not happy. Sleep not good. In 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, Paul says, we're not those that fall asleep. We're the children of light. We are awake. We're ready and prepared. So quite often in the Bible, in the New Testament, falling asleep means, you know, you're not alert, you're not aware, you're doing something wrong. In this parable, it's not even that complicated. All 10 of them fall asleep. All of them wait. All of them are in the right place. All of them are there. All of them have lamps. All of them sleep. None of them are actually ready. Do you understand that? When the bridegroom comes out, none of the 10 are standing there saying, yep, just what I thought. No one is prepared in that sense. No one's ready for what happens next. Some of them are prepared for what they didn't think they would need. Say that again. All of them sleep. None of them are ready. Some of them are prepared. All of them are taken by surprise. And I think that's an important element of the story, that he's being fairly kind to us. He's not just excoriating us and say, how dare you sleep? How dare you be unalert? He says, the story of Christianity and how it's unfolding, the story of God and what he's doing in this world, I understand that it's caught some of you napping. I understand Messiah has come and he is not what you had expected. I understand that you fell asleep. He's not even critical of it in this part of the parable. But what he does want to say is, even when you're not ready, you can be prepared. And that's what he goes to in the passage that follows, beginning in verse 6. But at midnight, there was a cry. Here is the bridegroom, come out to meet him. Then all those virgins rose and trimmed their lamps. And the foolish said to the wise, give us some of your oil, for our lamps are going out. But the wise answered, saying, since there will not be enough for us and for you, go rather to the dealers and buy for yourselves. And while they are going to buy, the bridegroom came, and those who were ready went in with him to the marriage feast, and the door was shut. Okay, so at the beginning of verse 6, surprise, he's here. And at that moment, watch the progression very carefully, at that moment, nobody's ready. They're asleep. They have to be woken up. Somebody has to come and say, hey, here he comes. Okay? Nobody's ready. But some of them are prepared. And so when the bridegroom actually gets there, the text goes on to say, these folks are now ready. They weren't ready a moment ago. They were asleep. They were napping. All of them were napping. All of them were caught off guard. But some of them were prepared. And so when the moment actually comes, the bridegroom doesn't even have to know they were napping. He comes and it looks like they were just standing there ready to go. Lamps all trimmed. Well, what about the others? The others are thrown into a state of panic. And everybody who has a family knows what this feels like, right? When you're trying to get out the door and suddenly everything goes wrong. The same kids, I mean, this is the shock for us every year at Easter. I contemplate this thought. The same kids who can find 5,000 Easter eggs in 10 minutes cannot locate two shoes in the house anywhere, right? And you're trying to get somewhere in a hurry, and suddenly you're in a state of panic, and nothing is going the way. And that's the way these folks are. They're not prepared. They don't have their things with them. And so the parable is a little bit confusing to me at this point because of what they try to do. First of all, they try to kind of, can we say, mooch off of the others? They say, hey, share a little. You've got some, we need some. And they say, no, we need this to be prepared, to be ready. When the moment comes, we have to be prepared now. We can't give you ours. It's non-transferable. And then they go out to the shops. Now, this is the strange part of the story to me. I don't know if Jesus is just kind of having a joke here or not. What are these shops? Do you suppose in ancient Jerusalem there was a lamp oil shop open at midnight, 24 hours? Come in anytime you need it, get your lamp oil. So that's kind of funny to me that Jesus, I think, is kind of having a joke. So they're going to go run around town looking for the 24-hour Walgreens that sells the lamp oil, and they find one. I mean, that's the shock. They even find one. They finally get some lamp oil. They do. They get enough that they can come back, and they get to not where the wedding procession began, and they don't meet it in the middle. They get to where it ends up. And they finally end up there. With suddenness, the bridegroom has arrived, and the time of preparation is now past. They don't get on board at the beginning because they're not prepared. They can't even catch up in the middle because it doesn't work like that. Where they find themselves is on the other side of a door looking in. They miss the joy for which they waited. Why do we have these processions and weddings? It's a celebration. In the old preaching books about how to officiate weddings, the officiant is called the celebrant. It's an old word we don't use anymore. The celebrant. I am the celebrator in chief, right? I am here to help you celebrate this joyous occasion, the celebrant will say. We don't use that word anymore. In England, you can still go hire a celebrant. Somebody can officiate your wedding. I still use that term. There's joy attached, and you wait for that, and you get there, and you missed it. What does that sinking feeling feel like to you? See, this one's easy for you to imagine. That's what I love about this parable. It's so easy to understand the feeling he's describing. Stop looking for a doctrine in the passage and look for the feeling he is describing. that sinking, gut-wrenching feeling. I was told a story. I won't even name names because I am a nice preacher. But they're here. I was told a story of some people who went all the way to Florida for a wedding and followed their GPS and went to the wrong place and missed the whole thing. I won't name any names, but it's Jim. Anyway, all the way out there and followed the GPS when they got there and they went and it took them to the wrong place. We'll blame the GPS. It couldn't have been your fault. And they missed the wedding. Can you imagine that moment when you realize you've missed it and what that felt like? Jim actually can. He can describe it to you if you're not sure. And his group. I'm just being mean now. So I'll pick on somebody else. I performed the wedding for Dalton and Kristen Path right here in this building. And my in-laws, whom I love dearly, in case they're listening to this recording later, wonderful people, know Dalton and Kristen from camp and wanted to come up to the wedding. And I'm officiating celebrant, and so they wanted to be there for that. And they showed up at the end. They showed up. They underestimated how long it took to get here or couldn't find their shoes or whatever it was that people do that makes them late. And they missed the whole thing and walk in at the end. Okay, you know what they felt like? They felt about this big. They're probably angry that I'm now telling Bill that they missed the whole thing. They feel about this big. It's a terrible, sinking feeling because you've missed out on something you were looking forward to. If you miss out on something you hate, you say, whew, got by with it. But if there's something joyous you're looking forward to, and you've been waiting and you thought you were ready, I mean, you put your nice clothes on, you got up that morning, you cleared the schedule, you did everything you were supposed to do except one thing, you weren't where you were supposed to be when you needed to be there. As it turned out, you're in the wrong place. You weren't prepared to be ready. And you missed it. And it feels like something has been stolen from you. Joy was taken away. Jesus says that's how these folks felt. And so in verse 11, afterward, the other virgins came also, saying, Lord, Lord, open to us. But he answered, truly I say to you, I do not know you. And that's the most severe part of the parable. That's when it stops being a cute story about weddings and being late and missing things, all which is fairly entertaining and enjoyable. He says to be unprepared is to be unknown. He says this has deeper significance. This is not a cute story about missing something that you can make up later. Have you done this? Have you gotten? You're going on a trip. You're going on a trip and you're going to fly. So what do? Clear your calendar, you make your plans, you figure out when you got to leave, you do everything right. You got your luggage packed, you check the TSA guidelines, you know how much shampoo you're allowed to have on your carry-on, you've got it all right, you get there an hour early, you walk through security, you do everything you're supposed to do, you get to the gate, no tickets. You left the tickets at home. And what you want to say to the ticket counter lady is, obviously, I'm supposed to be on this flight. I got up this morning at the right time. I've got bags. You don't pack bags unless you're going to go on a plane. Of course, I'm at an airport. Obviously, I'm supposed to be on that flight. And you know what the ticket counter lady says? No ticket, no plane. I never knew you. And it doesn't matter how passionately you plea or beg or how sincere you are or how sorry or how desperately you want to be on that flight. No ticket, no flight. And that's the sentiment that the man at the door expresses to these foolish virgins. Does he doubt that they are there for a wedding? Listen, they're running around at midnight in their wedding gowns with lamps in their hand. They're obviously not bandits, right? I mean, he knows what they're there for. But he says, I never knew you. I don't know who you are. The wedding party is on the inside. And they are rejected. Being unprepared at the end of the parable does not just make you a fool. It makes you uninvited. And this is the terrible and difficult truth that this parable tells that ultimately is going to get Jesus killed. in our charges against Jesus of Nazareth, we need to think of it this way. This parable has two basic meanings. As I said in Matthew 24, there are two predictions Jesus makes. One about a doom that was coming fairly quickly, and one that was ultimate and farther off. And I think you can see both of those in this parable. For Jesus, at that moment, to the people he was, remember, he's not talking to you. He's talking to people right in front of him that are going to crucify him in a day or so. And he says to them, Israel has been waiting for its hope. For generations, for centuries, your God has told you, hope is coming and everything will be made new. And you fell asleep. And he's not even concerned about that in the parable up to this point. He says, but you're not prepared. The hope of Israel has arrived and you are going to miss it. Not because it was unexpected, but because you weren't prepared for the unexpected. But then you remember that Matthew is repeating this parable for us. Jesus is speaking to people right in front of him. What do we learn from this? Do you realize we are repeating the same mistake? The same way that Israel, after so many years of waiting for its Messiah and King, missed the import of who Jesus is and his coming. Jesus gave us a message. He said, I'm coming back. I'm coming back. And we look at them and say, well, those dummies, they didn't know who he was. They weren't ready. And then what do? We go about our ordinary, boring, secular lives, unconcerned with the things of God, unprepared for the day of his return. No ticket, no flight. We arrive at the end and we realize that we are unprepared for the very thing we've waited on. And that's what I think it makes this parable hurt. Because we would like to think of Jesus as this very nice fella. He's the guy. If Jesus was at the ticket counter, he'd say, Ben, I know your kids couldn't find their shoes this morning. You left in a hurry. Probably the tickets are right there on the counter, aren't they? Come on board. You're a good fella. That's the Jesus I would like to think I know. And what Jesus tells us is, it doesn't work like that. That there are things that are necessary in response to what God is doing in this world. And you can't leave them off and expect to still be part of the joy that he's promising. What are the crimes of Jesus of Nazareth? The fifth charge against Jesus is this. He told us we were unprepared for our fondest hope. And that's the part that hurts. It's the thing they wanted most in the world. And they weren't ready for it. I believe that in this room today and on every Sunday morning, there are people who would tell me, if asked, that their fondest hope is the return of Jesus Christ, our Lord, and the goodness and reconciliation of the world that comes by him. Our dearest hope, surely it's that. Lord, come quickly. But if we have not responded with preparation of our lives, of morality, of our character, to be the kind of people that are on the inside of that door when he comes, we're not just unprepared, we're uninvited. How tragic would it be to miss your fondest hope over something as simple as a flask of oil? I would beg you this day to consider your life. Because you're missing a flask of oil. Somewhere in your life is that moral oversight you look at and say, well, that's not a big deal, it doesn't matter. Somewhere in your life is the lack of faith and commitment that you say, well, that's not a big deal, I'm waiting for Jesus. Somewhere in your life is the lack of faithfulness that makes a person prepared for the coming of Christ our Lord. Look at it seriously and ask yourself, am I prepared for the arrival of that for which I wait for and long for daily? Am I prepared for my Lord? And if you're not, put on Christ in preparation, in faith, repentance, and baptism to begin to live a life waiting and ready. Watch therefore, for you know neither the day nor the hour. As we stand and sing a word of encouragement, you may come.